Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. If there is one constant in urban American communities, it's dealing with crime and criminals. St. Louis is no exception, as daily headlines remind us. There are occasional bright spots. New techniques dealing with high crime areas seems to be working here. On the other side of the ledger, more young women seem to be turning to violent crime. There's always plenty to talk about with the chief of the Metropolitan St. Louis Police Department, Sam Dotson. He was sworn in as chief 8 months ago to the day. He joins me in studio along with University of Missouri St. Louis criminology professor Rick Rosenfeld. Rick has been working with the St. Louis Metropolitan PD as an analyst consultant on crime-fighting issues. Gentlemen, thanks both for being with us.
Thank you.
Don, glad to be here.
Well, 8 months to the day, chief. You've been with the department a long time. Any surprises for you in those 8 months as chief?
It's only been 8 months. That's a surprise for me. Yeah, and we've talked before. It's an emotional job. It really is. I worry about the safety of the officers, the safety of the community. And believe it or not, I take crime personally. When crime happens in the city, I want to make sure that we have a response and that we're addressing it. And so it's an emotional job that I take personally.
But you enjoy it as much as you thought you would on day one?
I do enjoy it as much. I have a little more gray hair now, but I enjoy it as much.
Well, at least you have hair. some of us can envy that. You know, Chief, the city of St. Louis has something of a reputation as a dangerous place. We've seen the headlines that I alluded to. When you read those headlines or hear that said, what goes through your mind?
I think it's a response to the media in a lot of cases. The city of St. Louis is now safer than it was in 1970. Just to give you an example, in the last couple of years, crime in the city of St. Louis is down 46% since 2006. Those are significant. That's a significant reduction, but it doesn't get reported in the mainstream media because there are consultants that come in that drive the conversation. TV stations need to make money. They make money by having viewers, and so they want something that's sensationalized at the beginning of their newscast. We were just this morning meeting with our senior commanders, like we do every Thursday, to talk about crime in the city of St. Louis. And Dr. Rosenfeld was there with us today. Hey, crime is down in the city of St. Louis for the first 8 months. It's down over 8%. That's on top of a 12.5% reduction last year. So crime is headed in the right direction. The CQ Press, Forbes, the groups that use the FBI statistics to rate cities do exactly what the FBI says not to do. St. Louis is unique. It's a city not within a county, and we're the urban core. If you look around the country and the cities they use to compare it to, Kansas City, for example, is over 300 square miles. They have the urban core, suburban, and rural to offset their crime numbers. The city of St. Louis, is the urban core. That's why Tim Fitch and I, the county chief, have been talking to the Highway Patrol and the FBI about combining crime statistics. And really, let's look at crime as a regional issue. We already know that criminals don't recognize city-county borders. People that offend in the city offend in the county. People that live in the city travel and eat dinner in the county. People in the county come to football games, baseball games. So let's look at crime as a regional problem, which is really what it is.
Yeah, we want to talk more about the cooperation between those two police departments because it's already started, and I assume it's going to continue. But, Rick, let me bring you into that whole dangerous city perception that St. Louis carries.
Well, I think the chief's absolutely right. The city is 76 square miles. That's a very small urban core. The city of St. Louis constitutes something on the order of 12% of the population of the metropolitan area. That puts it in a category, not by itself, but with very few other cities. City of Memphis, by contrast, very much like St. Louis, constitutes over half of its metropolitan area population. And when the city experiences the public relations disasters of those crime rankings you alluded to. Memphis does not, even though kind of on a neighborhood-by-neighborhood basis, these are very similar places. So that city-county divide is a very important one. Crime is down in St. Louis. It's not only down in St. Louis, though. The decrease in crime in St. Louis outpaces the decrease in crime in other cities that also rank pretty high in these ratings. So we're not only headed in the right direction, but we're headed there more rapidly than lots of other places.
Chief, why is crime down?
Well, that's actually, if I could figure that out, I'd bottle it. Really what I think it is that two things, and I think the professor can talk about more of a national perspective on it, but locally, what we've really done is focused our resources into the neighborhoods. Hotspot policing is an example, the initiative that we did in College Hill earlier this year and some other things. Really focus our resources into the neighborhoods that are experiencing crime problems. What we've realized is that type of targeted, focused enforcement has a real impact. And we're going to continue to do more of that. And I'm trying to change the culture in the police department. That's not a program. It's not hotspot policing. It's the way we do business every day.
Tell me in a little more detail what hotspot policing is. Now, I get the general drift. You go to places that have high crime. And then what?
And I try and describe it to the officers as point-and-click policing. That what we do is, and today we had a great conversation of not looking about historically where the crimes have occurred, but trying to have some predictive analysis to look at neighborhoods and say, during the month of August, this particular area experiences an increase in crime. Putting resources in there, doing activities that impact the crimes. You don't police for burglaries the same way that you do for aggravated assaults, the same way you would for homicides, for robberies. So identifying the neighborhoods that are having the problems, putting the resources in there, giving them specific instructions about how to attack the problems that neighborhood is seeing and the times of day, during the times of day, and then evaluating if you're successful or not and tweaking that.
Is it really a question of high visibility, letting the neighborhood know that officers are there?
I think it's a combination of high visibility, it's enforcement, and then it's once we arrest individuals, it's making sure that we get the right outcomes. Dr. Rosenfeld and I, along with the mayor and several other people, have been talking about the need in the city of St. Louis for an armed offender docket. One of the crimes that we see as tragic is an understatement of how it is. When people are engaged in violence in the city of St. Louis, it impacts not only the individuals but their families. It impacts the entire community. And so we see a need for a specific path for those individuals that we arrest with illegal guns to make sure that they get the outcomes. I think I've told the story on your show before. An individual that shoots at the police officers with an assault rifle gets probation. That's not the right outcome in the city of St. Louis if we're trying to reduce crime and keep people safe.
The armed offender docket is better known, perhaps, as gun courts, which went before the legislature last time around, didn't make it. But I understand it's going to come back up again in January. Rick, your thoughts about the gun courts or the armed offender docket?
Well, I've been part of that discussion with city officials, the chief, the heads of other criminal justice agencies in St. Louis for some time. And I think it's an absolutely not only terrific idea, I think it's essential to devote specific attention to those crimes that are in and of themselves very, very important, inherently dangerous, but also can be precursors to other gun-related crimes that are more serious, that can involve serious injury or death to a victim. I think the courts need to devote special attention to those crimes. My part of that process is to help provide information that would enable us to monitor the progress of that court. You know, St. Louis is not unlike other places. One criminal justice agency often has difficult time merging its information and, in a sense, talking to another. I've been part of a group that is creating a so-called integrated database that would enable us to follow somebody who's been arrested on a firearm-related crime all the way through the process, through the formal charging process, prosecution, sentencing, and outcomes of sentencing. Does that individual, if placed on probation, commit a new crime, especially with a firearm? Once we get that database up and running, we'll be able not only to monitor the progress of an armed offender docket, if and when it comes into being, but also the current situation, which, interestingly enough, we monitor by way of an anecdote. We don't really have systematic information that would enable us to follow whole cohorts of offenders or suspects all the way through the system.
Other communities, I'm sure, have and states have such dockets. How is
you
it?
You might think so. Oh, armed offender dockets.
Yeah.
Yeah. A few years ago, there was something, you know, when so-called specialty courts began to emerge, drug courts being the leading example. Yes, a number of places instituted what were typically called gun courts, but, you know, a number of those places now no longer do that, and I think there are a variety of reasons, but one is the gun court, the way it's operated in other places, is not the design that's being discussed here in St. Louis. We're not describing a system that would provide, in the first instance, remedial services or alternative sentencing options for people who commit very dangerous crimes. What we're describing is a system that would increase the transparency and consistency of processing, especially sentencing, of people who have committed very dangerous crimes. Once, if and when placed on probation, those people then would receive enhanced supervision, and they would be responsible to report back to the court periodically on their progress. That's a rather different kind of quote-unquote gun court, one I think that's likely to be more successful than what we've seen elsewhere.
While we're on the subject of firearms, Chief, I read recently that you need some new weapons in the department, that you're certainly outgunned when you talk about AK-47s, but I gather that what you're using these days as sidearms are almost obsolete.
Well, and actually that's not the conversation. The conversation is that the model of sidearm that we use is a Beretta 92. Beretta has stopped manufacturing that particular gun. And so we have a quantity of guns to get us into early next year for recruits and people that we bring onto the department. The conversation is really, do we stay with the 9mm that we have, a 9mm weapons platform, or do we move to a 40 caliber or something else? That's really what the conversation is about. But it really comes back to a core. Our 9mm has been successful. When we've fired at a target and struck that target center mass like our training tells us to do, the weapon's been effective. And so there's a conversation. If you think about it, the two bullets don't meet in the air and have a struggle and fight it out. It comes back to shot placement tactics on the part of the officer. The weapons that the officers carry are working well. The conversation is, what do we do because we don't have access to that weapon anymore? That's what we're looking at.
What about this notion, though, of being outgunned in general? I mean, the bad guys are carrying some pretty hefty stuff.
And again, it comes back to the conversation about training and putting the officers in a tactically advantaged position. Again, the two bullets don't meet in the air. So every time we've fired at a suspect and struck center mass, like our training teaches us to, the 9mm has performed. So the idea of at what point does it stop? And we'll laugh, but if you go to a 40, then the bad guys have 45s. And so do you go to a 45, and then do you go to a Desert Eagle 50 caliber? The other thing that I'm also always concerned about is how the weapon performs in an urban environment. Unfortunately, every time we fire a weapon, the shot doesn't land where we expect it to. In that case, the caliber of the gun is irrelevant because the shot didn't land where you anticipated or hit the suspect. But what happens to that errant round that misses the suspect, and how far does it travel, and what happens to it? So it's a much bigger conversation about than saying outgunned. What it is saying, our tactics are superior. Do we have superior tactics? Are officers trained, and are they able to deliver the shot? That's what we're really looking at.
That's Chief Sam Dotson of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. He's our guest on St. Louis On the Air today. He's in studio, as is Rick Rosenfeld, criminology professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We'll come back to our conversation in just a moment. We'd like to bring you into it. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can also reach us by email. Talk at stlpublicradio.org is the address. Send us a tweet at STL On Air. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis On the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with the Chief of Police here in St. Louis, Sam Dotson. And also with me in studio is Rick Rosenfeld, criminology professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, who works very, very closely with the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. And he is a consultant, analyst. I have a tweet here from Jacob who is asking for a breakdown. Is violent crime down, or is that mostly petty in response to crime being down 46%?
And that's actually a great question. Yep. Because violent crime in the city of St. Louis is down at a greater percentage than the property crime. The CompStat meeting we had, the weekly briefing we had today, the numbers are a person crime, that's homicide, robbery, aggravated assault, rape, down 20% year to date. There were over 700 fewer crimes during the first 8 months up to year to date than there were last year. So that has a greater decrease than property crime. Property crime is down 5%, 650 fewer crimes. When you put the two together, over 1,300 fewer crimes in the city of St. Louis, or an 8.8% decrease. So greater reductions in person crime and reductions in property crime.
What's going on with young women? I mentioned in the introduction that violent crime among young women is up. What's going on?
What we're seeing is that a shift in the culture, that young women, as they look for their identities, are competing against young males, and they want to prove themselves. So just as young males want to be the toughest guy on the street or an important influence broker in the neighborhood, so do the young women. And the way that they do it is to quickly resort to violence. We've had several instances this year where young women have been the catalyst in fights that have quickly escalated to violence with weapons. We've had situations where young women have coerced young men into going out and doing acts of violence for them. So really what it is the young ladies are looking for an identity, and they want to compete with their male counterparts, and they think that in order to do that, they have to be stronger, faster, and more violent.
Rick, I'm sure this is the kind of thing that you take a close look at when you see these trends develop.
Right.
How do you deal with this? I mean, we know the problem now, as the chief has just outlined it. What's the next step?
Well, let me, by way of background, though, indicate that over, you know, the period since the early 90s or even just back over the last 10 years nationwide, crime is down. Crime committed by and against young men and by and against young women trended down. The trend in the young women, the downward trend in the young women's crimes, however, is not quite as steep as the downward trend in the young men. Now, I haven't looked at the St. Louis data to see if there's an actual trend in crimes involving young women as perpetrators. I do know that traditionally, young women are also often involved in crime because they're part of neighborhood groups, sometimes gangs, sometimes affiliated gangs, that are closely identified with and operate in consort with male-dominated groups. I don't want to minimize for a moment the problem of young women becoming more violent. How does one deal with that? I suspect one deals with that from a law enforcement perspective, no differently than one would deal with crime, violent crime committed by young men. From a social services and family perspective, however, there may well be different supports and services required for young women.
Chief, I think I've seen you quoted as saying a greater level of outreach is necessary. Is that am I quoting you correctly on that?
Absolutely. And I was just at a town hall meeting, Demetrius Johnson, at the West End Community Center. And for 2 hours, residents from the area got up and talked about the issues and challenges. And it continually came back to, what are we, the community, doing for ourselves? We arrest 30,000 people a year. We can't police our way out of this. What we need are the social service programs. We need the family identities to come back. And if you think about society in general, we've become much more of a individualistic or an isolated society. We tweet, we blog, we Facebook, we get everything that we need in our house from our wireless systems, and we don't go out and meet the neighbors and that. And so any chance that I have to put officers out in neighborhoods to meet the people in the community, I ask the community to come out and meet the officers. I ask the community to start to know each other. Because when we were growing up, hey, the neighbors knew who the kids in the neighborhood were, and if they got out of line, they took care of business and told mom and dad that, hey, little Sammy was, you know, riding a skateboard down the street and shouldn't have done that. Now everybody's afraid to do that, or they don't know who to talk to. I think it's a real challenge that we have to get the communities, we have to get the neighborhoods, we have to get everybody involved moving the ball down the field.
But somebody else has to do that, not the police department.
Absolutely. I always say that the police department is the social service provider of last resort, or in some cases, first resort, because nobody else knows what to do or who to call. And sometimes we're the only ones that answer the phone 24 hours a day.
Going back to the problem with violence among young women, again, I think I've seen this, that putting female officers as resource officers in the schools might be one way to deal with that. Is that right?
We've actually – one of the things that I did was revitalize a centralized juvenile division in the police department. And the commander of that unit is a lieutenant by the name of Janice Bockstrug, because not only is she a very competent police officer and been doing the job for many years, she also understands this emerging issue. And so I think we always look for somebody that we can identify. identify with. And so to see Lieutenant Boxrock Janis in a command position in the police department, commands a unit that deals with juvenile crime, I think people can relate to that. And I think she is a great role model for young women in schools about what their potential can be.
Speaking of trends, this is hardly a trend, but it has been in the news recently, and that is a flurry of smash-and-grab crimes in this area. Hardly a trend, Chief, but it must be something you're concerned about.
Well, and I'm glad you said in the area, because it really is. And what we've seen are individuals that go out and steal vehicles, and then they go to Target, stores that we saw just one in the city of St. Louis, a pawn shop where they thought they could smash the window and grab things. These are a loosely knit group of individuals who have some identity together, whether it's a neighborhood or criminal enterprise, do two or three a night and then go away and then come back in a week and do two or three more. What we're doing is changing our patrol strategy to approach that and larcenies from vehicles. Larcenies from vehicles are the single largest crime category in the city of St. Louis, and it has been historically. And what we've seen is recently a target or an increase in those types of crimes. We've also noticed that criminals are targeting vehicles parked around sporting events, parked around events where you can't take your conceal and carry weapon into that event. We've seen over 100 firearms stolen this year from vehicles. That's an alarming number. I always worry about a legal gun, a conceal and carry gun, falling into the hands of criminals and becoming an illegal gun. So we are going to redirect some resources into smash and grabs and into larcenies from vehicles, because that's a significant growth area for criminals right now.
In my experience, the police departments around the country generally don't approve of these conceal and carry laws, putting more guns out in the street.
As a chief of police, I never see more guns as the answer to any problem. You talked at the top of the show about the emotion of the job. That's what keeps me awake at night. That's what keeps me from going to sleep. And what wakes me up in the middle of the night is worrying about the safety of our officers. We ask our officers to do a very dangerous job, sometimes in the middle of the night, to run down alleys chasing teenagers who are armed with a weapon sometimes and who don't value life and put that. Just last week, we had a 15-year-old who at gunpoint carjacked an individual, then took police officers on a 20-minute pursuit as he drove recklessly through the city of St. Louis, and the officers used their tactics. They used spike strips, a variety of things, to bring the car to a successful conclusion, and then tried to run from police. So that's what I worry about. This 15-year-old had no idea that using a firearm to rob this individual could put him in a situation where he could either be forced to use deadly force or encounter a police officer, and that police officer would have to make a split-second decision. More guns are never the answer. Just a couple of quick numbers. Over 300 million guns in the United States. That's 88 guns for every 100 people. In the city of St. Louis last year, there were 113 homicides. 85% of those were committed with firearms. We've had over 770 arrests for illegal guns in the city of St. Louis. Year-to-date, over 400 robberies involving a firearm, and over 300 assaults.
I remember seeing a Time magazine article during the height of the Cold War in which it was reported that there were more guns in the United States than were possessed by the Soviet and U.S. Army or U.S. military combined. That hasn't changed very much. Now, getting back to the young man who was chased the other night, in the future, is he going to be chased by a drone? Had to bring that up, Chief.
If I would have known, I would have had that much conversation. I think it's police departments, and I'll talk about the Metropolitan Police Department. As budgets tighten, as resources become more scarce, we have to do our job as efficiently and as effectively and as smartly and, most importantly, as safely as we possibly can. Police chases, pursuits, are one of the most dangerous things that law enforcement agencies around the country engage in. The Metropolitan Police Department has one of the more, I would say, more restrictive pursuit policies around the country, because we've seen what happens when 15-year-olds, when young people flee from officers and have no regard for the safety, their safety, the safety of the other drivers on the road or the police officers, bad things happen. So when we talk about the conversation about drones, what I'm looking for is a way to apprehend more criminals, to keep police officers safe, to keep the community safe, and really keep the suspect safe, because a great number of pursuits end in crashes where the suspect crashes the vehicle. So technology now allows for drones, unmanned aerial observation platforms, to be put to help monitor pursuits. Helicopters do that now, except helicopters are much more expensive propositions.
And noisy.
And there's a partnership between St. Louis City, St. Louis County, and St. Charles County, where we operate Metro Air Support. So we have helicopter coverage in the region for about 16 hours a day. But a helicopter, $2.5 million, plus fuel, plus flight crew, plus maintenance, plus, are very expensive propositions. For fractions of that, we could operate an unmanned aerial observation platform. And I want to be clear, unarmed, because that's the next question that's coming. Unarmed to help assist officers monitor pursuits. The question that I always get from the ACLU and from other groups is, well, what else are you going to spy on? I think that we know that if you're in a public space, there should be no expectation of privacy. If you walk into a bank, you're on video. If you walk into a shopping mall, you're on video. If you walk into a movie theater, you're on video. So the platform would be used to monitor public events. Boston is talking about drones for the marathon next year. We saw what video can do. Real-time video from Boston helped identify the bombers at the marathon. These are all tools that police departments need to utilize, especially as resources get tighter.
Rick, what did you think when you heard of this possibility or this suggestion?
Well, if you think about the drone as another tool in sort of the arsenal of police enforcement, I don't see it as qualitatively distinct from any other tools. I don't see it as qualitatively distinct from video surveillance cameras, which did help out clearly in the case of Boston and in other instances. And it's not qualitatively distinct from a helicopter that assists in police pursuits, except that it's much less expensive. And helicopters have always, of course, provide some risk for the person operating or persons operating the helicopter. So I see in that use, I don't have any problem with drones at all. What else drones might be able to do by way of essentially functioning as mobile, highly mobile video surveillance tools, I think remains to be seen. With all such devices, one always has to be careful to respect individual rights. You know, individuals don't lose their rights when they're in public, and respect privacy to the degree that's feasible. But in general, it seems to me drones can be an important part of what the police use to, especially in the case of facilitating police pursuits of dangerous suspects.
Back to the conceal and carry issue. We've all gone through this trial in Florida, the Trayvon Martin case. Stand your ground was a big issue there. How do you see that? How do you view that whole concept, Chief?
Hey, that's a very tough one. And again, as I've said, more guns are never the answer. Mm-hmm. So he believed that there was a threat to him.
Zimmerman
believed that there was a threat to him. In looking back after all of the facts are known, there was no threat. And so that's the danger that I see with conceal and carry and with the stand your ground, is that individuals make split-second decisions, and those split-second decisions don't have all of the facts. And so police officers go through extensive amounts of training, not an eight-hour conceal and carry class. They go through hours and hours and weeks of training, and still then in their minds run through these scenarios constantly. Every time you go on a call as a police officer, whether it's a burglary or a larceny, if I encounter a bad guy, here's what I'm going to do, here's what I'm going to do, here's what I'm going to do. I don't know if conceal and carry gets you to that level and gets you to that. So I certainly feel for everybody involved, but again, more guns are never the answer.
Another issue that gets a lot of attention, has been getting it for many months now, is what's going on in New York, the Stop and Frisk campaign. Good idea, bad idea?
And I think we both are probably in agreement, the doctor and I, on this. There are crime reductions in New York. I don't know if the crime reductions because of Stop and Frisk are any greater than the crime reductions that are happening around the country. What I do know is that New York is being challenged in many ways from ACLU and civil rights groups about the violations that happen in this policy. There is nothing now that precludes an officer from conducting a pat-down frisk in the city of St. Louis if he believes that there is a threat to you. What we don't have is a policy that tells us to go out and stop and frisk everyone that we see. So people will claim that it's working in New York. I don't know if the decreases in New York are at any greater pace than they are through the rest of the country.
Rick?
There's one published study the impact of Stop and Frisk in New York on crime. And I conducted it with my colleague Robert Fernando. We found no relationship between increases in Stop and Frisk and crime reductions in New York. Now, all studies have limitations. We're following that one up with what I think are somewhat more refined investigations. We may find something different. But so far, the evidence does not support the view that Stop and Frisk is responsible, not to mention wholly responsible, for the New York City crime decline.
Mm-hmm. And yet it continues.
Yes, it does.
Yes, it continues. I have an email here for the chief from John. Have any convictions or arrests even for violent crimes been concealed carry permit holders?
There are. Just because you have a concealed and carry permit does not give you the right to use your gun against another individual. So there have been arrests of individuals with conceal and carry permits for a variety of charges. There are also cases where individuals have used that weapon in defense of themselves or their property and have not been charged. So it can go both ways.
All right. That's the answer for John. We have a tweet from our own Rachel Lippman in the newsroom. She says, with a gun court, what about the resource issues raised by the court's presiding judge?
The question is, it really comes down to, we're not going to put any more offenders into the process. What we're looking for is a specific path that the court can have the offenders follow. So the question about the resources is not that they need more. It's prioritizing the resources that they have now. That's at least how I see it, in my opinion.
Right.
And the city has indicated its willingness to engage in very detailed discussion with the courts about, and for that matter, with the circuit attorney's office, about additional resources that could be made available. For example, hiring one or two more circuit attorneys that would reduce the whatever burden or additional burden might be imposed on the courts by the specialized docket. But I think the important point is the one the chief made. This is not increasing the overall workload of the court. It's simply realigning some of that workload to one or two judges who deal with these crimes and these crimes exclusively.
And one of the things I think is important to remember is that we're looking for outcomes for these individuals that keep the neighborhood safe. We rearrest individuals. The recidivism rate is extremely high in some areas. We continue to rearrest the same people. If there are outcomes, and this is important, if there are the right outcomes, we keep the people that are committing the crimes in jail, not allowing them out to reoffend and have more victims. And I've talked about the best I've found so far is a 5-time probationer. So if you think about this for a minute, you commit a crime and you get probation in the city of St. Louis. While you're on probation, you commit another crime. And while you're on double secret probation, you do it 3 more times. If the system had engaged the first time, that first, you'd have 4 fewer victims. That's what we're talking about, and that actually could relieve some of the pressure on the courts.
You're listening to Chief Sam Dotson, Chief of the St. Louis Metropolitan Police Department. He's with me in studio, as is Rick Rosenfeld, criminology professor at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, who is a consultant and analyst with our own St. Louis Police Department. We'll come back. We have a number of calls. I want to get to them when we come back. We'll do so in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Chief Dotson and Rick Rosenfeld in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Illinois Governor Quinn is signing a bill legalizing medical use of marijuana. Senator McCaskill is chairing a hearing on problems with the Pentagon program that finds, identifies, and returns the remains of American troops missing in action. And this afternoon, Normandy School Superintendent McNichols discusses the transfer process and accreditation concerns. Today is the last day that Normandy and Riverview Gardens parents can request a transfer for this fall. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to the chief and Rick. Medical marijuana is signed in Illinois. Let's go to a question regarding marijuana here. And this comes from Rory Ellinger, one of our representatives in Jefferson City. Rory, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Don. And I, first of all, I want to say much more important than marijuana, I really want to applaud the chief, also Jennifer Joyce, and work in terms of what I would call targeted law enforcement, going to those neighborhoods, putting a heavy police presence to stop, in my opinion, the number one problem, far more important than the marijuana problem, and that's the death of young black youth. And I really applaud the efforts being made. I'm glad to hear from Rick that the figures are starting to show the decrease. I introduced a bill last year to adopt the Columbia, Missouri model, where it does not decriminalize marijuana, but the officer uses it, just gives a ticket, doesn't book the person. And if a person completes their sentence, their probation period, it comes an SIS, suspended imposition of sentence. It doesn't go on their permanent record. I now looked at the fact that two more states have absolutely legalized marijuana. So the trend definitely from my many Republican friends, particularly in outstate Missouri, who tell me quietly that they really support what I'm doing. I would be interested in the reaction of these two experts on how it would affect law enforcement. Do they think it's a danger, the pros and the cons? And thank you for having this these good folks on today, Don.
Rory, thank you for your call. Let's get a response.
And I'll start. The city of St. Louis has actually taken some steps similar to what you've described, not to decriminalize marijuana, but to make the process easier for officers. We've worked out a process where you can receive an ordinance violation instead of the state misdemeanor charge if you're caught in possession. And we're currently even looking at refining the process to allow it to be more like a ticket, in kind of the analogy that you used. My concern around that is, in law enforcement, there is always a nexus between drugs, violence, and guns. And so I haven't seen anything that has at least convinced me that the decriminalization of marijuana, because it'll still have a value, it'll still be a desired commodity, it'll still have a cost, will take that nexus away. And so even though it's of the drugs, it's considered one of the lesser ones, I still see a considerable amount of violence that comes from the trafficking and trade of marijuana.
Anything to add to that, Rick?
Only that as I've looked at the relationship between drugs and crime, there may be such a connection, but it's far weaker than the connection that we saw some years ago between, say, the marketing, not to mention use of crack cocaine in crime, or even heroin in crime. Now, I think an important point here is that the same individuals and groups who market those harder drugs are also marketing marijuana. Marijuana has always been the gap filler. One drug becomes popular, declines in popularity, marijuana fills the gap. So to the degree that groups that are street marketing marijuana are also into heroin, cocaine, and other hard drugs that are connected to violence, that becomes a problem.
Right. Let's bring in Mike from University City. I think we'll continue this part of the conversation. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Don, and hi, having a brain block. But the simple issue is that the restriction of freedom brings bad results. The war on drugs creates alternate societies, these drug societies that are in our community, that have no respect for the law, that they have no police protection for their business, and whether it's marijuana or whatever, they up the scale, the repression of the drugs, the ability of people to take drugs, it does not stop the demand. And so we have these countercultures in our midst that the violence results because they have guns. The kids in the inner city are put upon by this business. They have to join gangs. Just for their own protection, so they become part of the process. And again, they learn to the street, total chaotic, alternate culture that has no laws except the law of power. And that an officer, Dotson, you have to face that directly. And the kids that are in the communities have to face that. And there's a breakdown of the community when you have a powerful drug culture that you can't. Tell on them. So that's part of our problem, the fact that it's a very simple notion of freedom that we're violating.
Mike, we have the point, and time's getting away from us.
Yeah.
Let's get a response.
Thanks.
Rick, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some positive trends here. One is that the use, population surveys suggest that the use of cocaine is way down. The use of heroin is flat. Every once in a while it flares up in particular communities, but it's certainly not galloping up nationwide. Marijuana use it continues to increase a bit, again, as the gap filler. But, you know, generally speaking, those trends suggest that the demand that is filled by drug suppliers and generates the drug culture the caller describes, that demand, at least for now, is weakening. And that's a good thing.
And I think it's also important to realize that the effect that these drugs have in our communities, that there's no question that the crack epidemic of the 90s and into the early 2000s have left some communities decimated. And so while I understand the point that he put forward, the caller put forward, about individuals looking for identities in the community, what's happened is that in a community that's already struggling with poverty and variety of issues, now has substance abuse issues. And those substance abuse issues have really fractured the family structure. And so now in some cases where you were dealing with a single parent family, substances, drug abuse have come in and left those families really struggling, where you have mothers that are in their early 20s, grandmothers that are in their early 30s, mm-hmm. and children are left really without any parental guidance at those points. So I think it's the drugs, not only the trade aspect of it, but the use and the abuse problems that have happened that have really taken parts of our community and decimated them.
There again, you're on the receiving end of bad social policy, I suppose, mm-hmm. is the way we can put that. Back to the issue of gun courts with Michael, calling from the Central West End. Go ahead, Michael.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Good. Go ahead.
One of the things I liked about, or I guess kind of liked about the Florida Trayvon Martin case was that if Mr. Zimmerman was convicted, he would have had to serve the full sentence because he had used a gun in a crime. I was wondering if Missouri or St. Louis has laws like that, or if there's anyone that's working on laws to do that for Missouri or St. Louis. And I'll take my call off the air.
Okay, go ahead, Chief.
There are some crimes that have mandatory minimums associated with it. Armed criminal action is one that has a mandatory minimum and required. I will tell you that assault on a law enforcement officer is one that does not have a mandatory sentence opposed to it.
Incredible.
And so there is a conversation among law enforcement about proposing some legislation in the upcoming session that would require the courts, because – and I've had these conversations with the judges. They have as much of a responsibility to keep the community safe. I understand that justice is blind, but once an individual has either pled guilty or been convicted of a crime, the courts have a responsibility to make sure that the outcomes that they impose keep the community safe. If they're not willing to do that, I think we have to legislate it.
Any thoughts? Move ahead. I have an email from Carol here I'll read to you. The new Metro St. Louis Coalition for the Homeless has been receiving reports of homeless individuals being harassed by the police, sometimes arrested. Homeless people are being told to move and tent encampments are dismantled. Do you have any thoughts about the criminalization of the homeless and how widespread this might be? Any suggestions on what will happen if the New Life Evangelistic Center closed and about 200 more people are on the streets every night?
And from a regional perspective, St. Louis is very fortunate. We don't have the homeless issues that some cities do. We do have homeless problems. St. Louis, the city of St. Louis, becomes a repository for the region's homelessness. When communities look to rid themselves of homeless, they simply ship them to St. Louis because downtown, as she mentioned, New Life Evangelistic Center, St. Patrick Center, the Bridge, all of the service providers are located in the urban core. It is not illegal to be homeless, but the behaviors that homeless people can engage in sometimes are illegal and do cause police officers to engage. So I think those are two distinct factors that you have to consider. Being homeless is not a crime. Urinating in public, littering, a variety of things, drinking in public, all of those are activities that homeless engage in. But the piece that we're missing is, again, we go back to that social service piece. A significant portion of the population of homeless people in the city of St. Louis have mental illness, aren't receiving the proper supervision, the proper care that they need. And so, again, the police department becomes the caregiver of last resort because nobody else is there to fill that gap.
Agreed. Back to the phones. We'll bring in Matt this time, calling from St. Louis. Matt, go ahead.
Right, this may take me a little while to get this all out.
We don't have a whole lot of time, Matt, so make it as quick as you can, please.
As I can. I believe a couple of years ago there was a law passed that it was made it a criminal offense to video the police in their job. Now, if you take the premise that the population has no expectation of privacy while they're in public, how do you square that with the criminal offense of videotaping the police?
Okay, Matt, thanks for the call. Having shaking heads in front of me, I don't believe there is any.
I think you started with the wrong premise. There is no law that I'm aware of in the state of Missouri that prohibits anyone from filming a police officer and their activities and their actions. So I think if you take that out of it,
Right.
There was a law in Illinois, and I think it's no longer exists, about taping, audio taping police officers, I think, under certain conditions. But that's
such laws.
And I think that as a police officer, I conduct myself professionally every day. I have no objection to being filmed myself or the actions of the officers being filmed. So I think I want to say that just to be clear. There is no hesitation on the part of law enforcement. Our actions are transparent, are in the light of day, and we should not be fearful of anything that we do.
That would put the local TV stations out of business, for crying out loud.
There's an idea.
Could generate a paparazzi problem for police officers.
Let's go back. We started this conversation talking about the media. Let's come back to it just for a moment because time is getting away from us. Are you ever inclined to have conversations with news directors in town about what I'll call the over-coverage of inconsequential crime?
I have. I've taken them to lunch. I've sat down with them and discussed it. And it really becomes a financial equation for them that they're pushed by their companies to have ratings. And people tell them that crime stories sell. And so therefore, they do them. I don't know how to overcome that. And actually, I've sat with the RBC, Kathy Osborne, at the Regional Business Council, and said, let's bring together the business leaders of the community and have a real conversation with the media saying, that's not what we want in our community. We want true and accurate reporting. And I always want to be clear. If there is something that needs to be reported, I never want to filter the news. I never want to censor the news. But what I want is fair, balanced, and reasonable. I mean, breaking news in St. Louis is one thing. Breaking news in St. Louis that happens in Ocala is not breaking news in St. Louis. And so let's be balanced.
Rick, I've heard this described as a disservice to the community.
Well, I think it is when all the community receives is news of the most dramatic crimes that have occurred. Outside of any context, the context that we were providing earlier of this really quite substantial crime decline that's occurred in the city. I've been in conversation with reporters and editors of a large daily hard copy newspaper that shall go nameless about creating a half page, no more, that would deal with crime and justice issues periodically, perhaps once a month, that would put the local crime news in national context, but also in broader context. That's what we have on the business page that appears every day in every local newspaper. We get dramatic news, you know, companies up, companies down, but we always have the context of the stock market and other economic indicators that are providing the background for the more dramatic story. We don't have that in case of crime, and I think that is a disservice.
Yeah. I use the word inconsequential crime, which is not a good word to use because all a crime, of course, does have consequences, but some of it is more meaningful than others, needless to say, and so much of it gets covered. Only a little time left, Chief. The horses are coming back to Forest Park.
Well, they actually never left. And so
I haven't seen one in a long time.
So the horses are in Forest Park, and along with many other officers, golf carts, ATVs, we spend a lot of energy and resources. Forest Park is a jewel for the region, the zoo, the history museum, science center. We want to make sure that people come and have a great experience. So you will see more horses in and around the park.
How effective are they? Just as, they're certainly fun to look at and watch. Are they, well, I don't know how to phrase the question here in terms of their capability of stopping crime.
I'm working with a professor to teach horses how to hotspot.
Okay, we'll let it go at that. A final thought in 15 seconds from either of you?
One final thought to just close the circle on hotspots policing, which is certainly an effective enforcement policy, but I don't think it's unrelated to social interventions that can get at some of the so-called roots of crime. To the degree it becomes more difficult for young men and young women in a disadvantaged community to commit crime on the street, to that degree they are more open to whatever legitimate opportunities that exist, not to mention social services that exist. So we don't want crime competing with those services for the attention of young people.
We're going to have to leave it there. I'm afraid time is getting away from us. Chief Dotson, thanks so much for being with us. Good to see you again. Congratulations on surviving your first 8 months. Rick Rosenfeld, thank you for being with us.
Sure.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, and he'll talk with John Aldani about his books on St. Louis folklore and St. Louis-isms. Photographer Jerry Tovo about his exhibit documenting the plight of homeless veterans and about Jazz St. Louis's American Music Showcase in Grand Center. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, and Spencer Reed. Executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.